This is Reasons to be Cheerful, live from the Underbelly Festival, South Bank. Please welcome to the stage Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyds.
Hello.
Hello.
I see you've gone for both sleeves down.
Yes, I have.
But your cuffs unbuttoned.
Yeah, I think I might go for the one sleeve up fashionable look.
Actually. Yeah, do the Ed.
Does anyone else know the fashionable look, one sleeve up?
Anyone else doing the Ed today?
That's an interesting shirt.
You know when you say interesting, yeah. Nobody ever takes that as a compliment.
I am a sort of shirt shamer, I'm afraid.
Yes,
I'm,
you aren't, are. You are. Thank you for coming. Anybody been to one of these before? Okay. Anybody not been to one of these before?
That's good.
Either way, it's good. If they haven't, then it's fresh blood. If they have, then we're ever closer to starting a cult, which I know is something you aspire to.
Right. Shall we do our reasons to be?
Yeah, I'm just going to have this shirt as my reason to be cheerful, in defiance of your unkind remarks.
It's a nice shirt.
Your voice went very high as you
said
that.
Yeah, it did, actually, yeah.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, my reason to be cheerful actually relates to the podcast, which is that, have people heard of Parkrun? Who does Parkrun? So I'm really proud of myself because, so the podcast got me into Parkrun. I first went on, well, we went in the beginning of December, and then I went on Christmas, dragged my family there on Christmas Day, which was sort of not great for them. But and we went to Parkrun this Saturday. I went with my kids, and Parkrun was off because there was a festival going on in the park. But I did it anyway.
Wow.
Isn't that good?
You did your own Parkrun.
I did my own Parkrun.
Can I just say that on Christmas Day, Ed also came to my front door and we all just sat there pretending not to be in.
Is that true?
We didn't know you were there until afterwards. But were you trying to persuade me to go to Parkrun with you?
I'm always trying to persuade you to come to Parkrun.
I know, I'm otherwise engaged.
Should we talk about what we're going to talk about?
Yeah.
So we're
you want to see the Constitution.
You want to what?
Oh, it's a Beatles lyric. They're a band from the
60s. Right, I see, yeah. popular culture and all that. So we're talking about our constitution or our sort of non-constitution, and really, what do we do about the fact that we don't have a constitution or don't have a codified constitution? And I think, in a way, Brexit has kind of raised this up the agenda because people will see that Dominic Raab was threatening to prorogue Parliament in the middle of the Tory leadership election. People weren't quite sure whether that could be done or not. Parliament, you know, has spent the last 2 years not being quite sure what it can do. And so I'm delighted to say that we've got Professor Jeff King with us, who is Professor of Law at UCL, and Dr. Hannah White from the Institute of Government, talking about why don't we have a constitution? You know, should we have a constitution, and what would it mean for us?
You might be sitting here thinking, Does that sound that exciting?
It does.
You've got to wait.
Does it sound that exciting?
You'd be very good in panto.
Let's invite Jeff King and Hannah White onto the stage.
Thank you both for coming. Just to start, can we go through the basics of what is a constitution? How common is it for countries to have one? Are we that unusual? Do we have a constitution despite the fact that it's not written down? Can we sort of go through those things?
Sure.
Maybe first of all, that sort of what is a constitution?
Sure. So a constitution is that set of rules, customs, principles, judicial decisions that tell you what the main organs of government are, you know, the legislature, the executive, the various branches of government, the courts, and so on, and which also provide rules for how you resolve disputes between different branches of government, let's say local and central government, or, and most commonly, between citizens and the government.
And at what point in a country's history does a constitution typically get drawn up?
Every country has to have a constitution because it has to have those kinds of rules, especially those rules that define how you make law. If you don't have those rules, you don't really have a legal system. At the moment, there are only three countries that I know of that don't have a codified written constitution.
Three countries in the whole world.
That's right. New Zealand, Israel, and the United Kingdom. So it's uncommon to not have the constitution codified in this way. That doesn't make it bad, but it's uncommon.
And what is the overview of how it is here? Because we hear about us not having a written constitution. What do we have?
So what you have is a good 750 years of development of customs. Conventions are often called, like that the Queen must give royal assent to a bill that's been passed by Parliament, or that an act of Parliament is the highest form of law. These things have evolved slowly over 750 years. And many of them predated the arrival of democracy by many hundreds of years. So the view generally is that the amongst many scholars, is that the Constitution has adapted eventually in every case. When we needed to reform the Lords, we reformed the Lords. When we needed legislatures in the devolved areas, that happened eventually.
Haven't really reformed them. We've reformed the Lords a bit, but
right.
And we've kicked out the hereditary peers, sort of. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say that's true, that Lords reform didn't quite finish all the way when some political party stopped it from happening. I think it was 2011.
What? That was me, apparently. Was that me? I don't think so. Why don't we have a written constitution or a codified constitution?
So I think there are historical reasons, and there are reasons of principle, and there are also reasons because of vested interests. So historically, in most countries, you have some great upheaval, and then there's a decision to either create the institutions of government or fundamentally reorient them. And that's a sort of big bang moment in a country's politics. Britain's never really had that. So it's not quite had that. It's been a process of evolution rather than, you know, having that big bang moment. So that's one reason. Another is that there's a principle, a political argument, that arguments of principle and grand design are really not that welcome in political and constitutional affairs in the country. So Edmund Burke in particular had that view. The thought was, we don't like the sort of American or German style grand theorizing that the people rise up and have a constitution, but that we have a good one that's working and we make adjustments as they're needed along the way. So it's a preference for incremental reform rather than big reform. I think it's more democratic, and it's harder to do it all at once. So that's the principled argument. But then I think that a really important reason is that there are vested interests in both of the leading political parties. The current constitution allows either of them, which have alternated in power in the last 100 years, to do essentially what they want once they're in power.
That's the elective dictatorship.
The elective dictatorship point is simply that whichever party takes a majority of the House of Commons can basically do what it wants, and it often takes that majority with less than 50% of voters behind it.
Hannah, you worked, before working in the Institute for Government, worked as a clerk in the House of Commons for 10 years. What was it like implementing our sort of non-codified constitution?
Well, I think one of the aspects of the written but non-codified constitution that we have is that parliamentary rules are part of that. Parliamentary rules are one of the things which are written down and that have to be interpreted to decide how the country should run. My job was to interpret those rules and help members of parliament and the speaker and so on understand what they meant and what they meant for what should happen. And so, for example, one of the things I had to do was when a new law came along called the Freedom of Information Act, and I was running a committee, and it's normally the case that committees in the House of Commons are covered by something called parliamentary privilege. And parliamentary privilege is a convention that MPs can't be prosecuted for something that they do in Parliament, something they say in Parliament. It's important to protect
MPs. So you can't libel someone in Parliament.
Exactly. You can't be prosecuted for libel if you say something. So when Freedom of Information came along, I had to think from the point of view of the committee I was running, what would take precedence, freedom of information or parliamentary procedure, a parliamentary privilege in relation to what the committee was doing. And this turned out to be quite important in relation to the expenses scandal, because what some MPs tried to argue was that they couldn't be prosecuted for having misused their expenses because what they were doing was covered by parliamentary privilege.
Right.
And the courts actually found that claiming of expenses was an administrative process and that privilege didn't apply. But that's just an example of where, on a daily basis, I had to decide how to do my job by interpreting the interaction between law and convention.
And this has been very clear, hasn't it, with Brexit? Because, you know, it has felt very much make it up as you go along from the beginning. Cameron called the referendum 50 plus 1%. Very narrow, obviously. Then, you know, it's been subject to the sort of courts and Parliament sort of arguing and trying to work out what its power is.
I mean, that's right.
Would that have happened in a different system? I mean, presumably they have a way of governing referenda in these systems. constitutions?
They often do. But I think, I mean, the direct answer to your question is I don't think that there would have been the degree of uncertainty. We had an important Supreme Court case which had to clarify that the Prime Minister could not notify the European Union that we're leaving and start the clock on the negotiation period until an Act of Parliament was passed. Well, that was contested by government. It took a Supreme Court case to answer that question. I think in most countries with a written constitution, that wouldn't have happened.
Right.
What about the amount of discretion that, say, John Bercow has had? Would that be different if it was a more codified constitution?
I think not necessarily. I mean, it depends on the constitution. And we've had a lot of people say over the course of Brexit that the lack of clarity over what's happened in Parliament means we're in a constitutional crisis. But actually, in lots of ways, John Bercow has just been playing his role to interpret the aspect of the constitution that's there. And any constitution is going to have to be interpreted. There's a question about who gets to do the interpretation. And I think it's right to say that in a more codified situation, it's more frequently lawyers and judges who get to interpret.
I mean, it is a slightly crazy situation, though, isn't it? That, I mean, I was talking to a Conservative MP who shall remain nameless, and he was saying to me that he was incredibly depressed about Boris Johnson winning, because he just felt he was going to power through to no deal, take us out without a deal, even though there wasn't a majority in Parliament for it, and that there wasn't a kind of lockdown way of stopping him doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, that just seems like, and it's just, we don't quite know if Parliament votes against no deal, can it stop him or not stop him? Would it go to court?
So one of the practical difficulties with a constitution is that there are a number of anachronisms lying around in the constitution, like loaded guns, essentially. The idea with prorogation is that the prime minister can advise the monarch to prorogue or to terminate this calendar year of parliament and stop all business in this calendar year, and it will restart in, say, November. The idea was that by stopping parliament from meeting, the default position of no deal on the 31st of October would just happen.
Don't you think, if we looked at another country where there was this, not just uncertainty about the issue, but uncertainty about who could do what and all that?
To an extent, it looks anachronistic. It's true that in Canada and Australia, they've also had incidents with prorogation of parliament, so it's not, and they both have written constitutions, so it's not like you get rid of them right away. But it would be rare. In most countries, this kind of situation just wouldn't arise. It's just that the interaction between the prime minister and the monarch under our system means that some of these old powers of the monarch are just left there on the belief that they'll always be exercised according to democratic principle. But when you get into crises like this, it exposes that, you know, it's very problematic.
Hannah, what do you, I mean, do you, you're thinking that Brexit, the Brexit sort of mess might not have been prevented by a written constitution?
Well, I think that, as Jeff has said, what Brexit has demonstrated is that people don't understand our constitution. They don't understand lots of aspects of it. I've spent a lot of my time,
including most MPs.
Well, I've spent a lot of my time on TV trying to explain what's happening in the House of Commons. And that's just not desirable for any country. Everyone needs to understand, in my view, the rules of the game. Now, it's not the case, as again Jeff's pointed out, that just writing things down necessarily makes everything super clear. And one of the important things to remember is that the act of writing it down will involve decisions. Because there are things that aren't clear, there will be decisions to be made. And so it's a process. It's not just one day we might decide that actually it'd be better to have this all in one place, so we just do it. It actually would be an active process to say we want to codify our constitution.
Jeff, can we ask you about your idea, your proposal
for
a constitution?
Sure. So
this is the Jeffocracy.
Yeah, but the J Jeffocracy.
Yeah, J Jeffocracy. Yeah.
Okay. Well, my Jeffocracy is quite democratic. I mean, that's the point of the argument.
Unlike yours.
So the argument that's often presented for having a written constitution is that it would clarify the constitution, this is what we've been talking about, or that it would protect people's rights against majority decision-making in parliament or amongst the people. And my argument is slightly different. I think there's some merit to both of those arguments, but the fact is actually the way that countries perform in protecting civil liberties does not always go along with its court's capacity to strike down legislation. Organizations like Freedom House keep track of which countries are best at protecting civil liberties. And the majority of the top countries don't have this practice, actually. So that's a bit embarrassing.
Don't have...
the practice of courts regularly striking down legislation that violates
the Constitution.
But
they will have written constitutions.
They will. Yes, yeah. They do. Exactly. Yeah. They do. And so you don't need to... these powers don't necessarily go together. The clarity argument is a bit better because we've seen there's a lot of uncertainty in the Constitution. But if, you know... you might be purchasing that clarity at a very high price if the constitution that you adopt has a lot of features that are not good. So if it's really hard to amend, it means you could lock in bad policy. If the courts become central political players, that might be bad for the reasons we see in the United States.
So there's a bad constitution?
I feel it does, yes. You probably want to know why.
Yeah.
It's remarkably hard to amend. You need majorities in both houses of Congress, as well as, I think it's 3/5 of the states to agree. Representation in the Senate is not proportional to population. You have two senators, regardless of how large a state is. And
Hillary Clinton could win the win the popular vote by, what was it, 3 or 4 million, and still lose, and then there's no chance really of amending the way that works, I mean, for future elections.
Yes, this is another issue with it. Although electoral systems are not always regulated by constitutions,
right.
But yes, that's another problem. So my case for the Constitution is simply that the people should be involved and have the right to decide what the laws are in the country. We always accept that for acts of parliament. We accept that the government sometimes makes delegated legislation or regulations with authority given to it by parliament. I'm saying that all of the rules and principles of the Constitution should also be decided by the people or the representatives of the people.
And how would you go about doing it? Because you've got a specific proposal about how it should happen.
Indeed. So my view is that you can either appoint, you can have the executive try to do it. It could be try to be run by an ambitious prime minister. Gordon Brown had tried this. Or you can create a commission of experts. What I don't like about those is that ultimately you'll have to send whatever you come up with to Parliament. Now, why should Parliament not be the one with its hand on the reins? It's because constitution making should be a cross-party affair. And it's the nature of Parliament that a majority of a single party can, with much less than 50% of the popular vote behind it, stop things from happening there. And it's also not in the interests of either the Conservative Party or the Labour Party to pass this through. So I don't think Parliament should have its hand on the reins, neither should it be the executive. What I think it should be is a specially convened assembly, technically a constituent assembly, sometimes called a constitutional convention, which would be composed of people that would write the Constitution and put it directly to the people for approval by referendum. Now,
and the Irish didn't do that, but they have used a constituent as a deliberative processes in the last few years.
Indeed. So let me just distinguish between a citizens' assembly and a constituent assembly. Citizens' assemblies get together and deliberate about important issues, and then they have a report, and then that will go to the legislature, which will decide how to act on it. What I'm talking about is different. They would actually write it. And it would go straight to the people. They'd consult Parliament, but Parliament wouldn't have a veto power on this. And that's important for the reasons I gave already. So the Constituent Assembly would be 2/3 directly elected and 1/3 appointed, a direct appointment of citizens chosen by sortition. And I understand that you're great sorticianites. You always have been, apparently.
So 2/3 of people come from where?
2/3 would be directly elected by the people. In my proposal is that it's done by a proportional representation system. And for those,
so they would have party labels, probably.
Exactly. And that's crucial in my proposal, because you have to remember, writing a constitution is really complicated business. It's not like one issue, abortion or gay marriage. This is the whole constitution.
How do you avoid it just being a snapshot of where a country is at that particular point in its history?
It could be, and it's part of my argument that I don't argue for any particular constitution, but only for the process, because if you say what it should be, then it's not really a democratic argument. But what I expect to happen is that a lot of issues like Lords reform, the voting system, the role of Parliament in adopting treaties, the nature of the Bill of Rights, these will come up necessarily for discussion. That's just how these exercises work. And I think once they're faced in this kind of context, when the results are not dominated by one party, then you're going to get different answers than we now have.
And when you were working for Gordon Brown, he had this idea. We've told the story on the podcast before that Ed found an old BlackBerry.
Yes, I did.
He decided that last year
history could have all been different.
Ed was doing a digital detox last year. He got rid of his iPhone and found an old BlackBerry. And you found an email from Christmas Day 2000.
I think it must have been 2004, I think.
From Gordon Brown.
Or maybe 2006.
Yeah.
With a proposal for a written constitution in it. And I was sort of annoyed that he'd emailed me on Christmas Day. But clearly I should have sort of paid more attention to it.
So it's your fault, basically.
Yeah, it is basically my fault. I've still got the email somewhere.
But at the time...
Yeah.
I mean, did it not feel like an exciting idea? Is that part of the problem?
It did feel like an exciting idea. But I tell you what, I think the problem was... I remember having a conversation with Tony Blair, and he said to me, look, this constitutional thing that Gordon's proposing is not going to... This is, I think, after he'd gone, or maybe after Gordon had taken over, or just before. It's just not going to butter any parsnips, really.
You're not going to do it in your Tony Blair impersonation?
I'm not going to do it. No, it's not going to butter any parsnips. But I think we kind of rechristened this the Uncle Melvin question.
Yeah. So how would we get my
Jeff's
uncle?
Got an uncle called Melvin. Why should Uncle Melvin care about this?
Right. So for the same reasons that you believe that you should be able to vote for parliamentary elections, the same reasons that you think that acts of parliament are passed, that you should participate in that process, you should also be even more concerned about the most fundamental rules in the society, not just the Dangerous Dogs Act, but what the Constitution itself is. So that's the main argument of principle.
And how we're governed, I suppose.
Precisely. Yes.
Where does power lie? Is there more local government, the House of Lords, all of that stuff?
Exactly.
And presumably the monarchy is up for grabs in this too.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I think it will still be there after the exercise, but the extent of its powers, you know, whether how does royal assent function? How does prorogation function? The prerogative of mercy, these questions will be on the table.
So, you know, you talked about these different points in a country's history, be a revolution or, you know, some kind of major event.
Yeah.
Could Brexit be the time, post-Brexit, to think about this and think about it as a way of unifying the country?
I think it could be. Whether it unifies a country is another question. But what you see with Brexit as the I don't think that a written constitution would have necessarily stopped Brexit. I think it would affect how it happened. What I think, though, and neither do I think it doesn't lie in my mouth to say here's a constitution that would have prevented Brexit or would have stopped it or made it better. So I don't want to suggest that my argument will do something to ameliorate the Brexit situation. But I think at the same time that Brexit is a crisis. It's a crisis for both parties internally as well as facing the electorate. It's an occasion where we see a surge of a populist variety of politics that is incredible. It's an occasion for nationalist politics in Scotland, which could be destructive of the union, to become incredibly powerful at this time. And so I think there will be a multi-layered, complex crisis, and it may be that a really inclusive constitution writing process could provide some palliative to that.
Hannah, what do you think about this proposal, just from your Institute of Government or personal...
Would it have made your job easier?
I think if people had felt engaged in the process of deciding these questions, then they would have a better idea how they were going to play out in a situation like this. I think the issue for me with Jeff's proposal is really a practical one. So, you know, he's talked about how to constitute his assembly in order to essentially break the stranglehold of Westminster over the process to ensure that you've got these people who are part of the constituent assembly who have been appointed through sortition. But my question is how you get Parliament to a point where it would initiate this process, because my sense is that Parliament's latest encounter with a sort of with a direct democratic process hasn't been a very comfortable one. And although, you know, the vast majority of MPs are totally signed up to delivering the outcome of the referendum, the idea of giving away power, which, you know, I see your argument of, you know, involving the parties in order to make it not entirely seem like that. But the idea, and also there's a, I mean, just to be totally practical at the moment, there's a massive bandwidth issue.
Yeah.
I mean, this would be a massive process opening up all these most fundamental questions about the way our countries run. And therefore, it would be really important to get it right. And at the moment, you know, government is completely sort of subsumed by the task of doing Brexit, which is a massive task. Legislation, reorganising systems, setting up new systems, bringing all this legislation back from the EU. And there's just a capacity point. That doesn't mean it's not a good idea in principle.
Is there something, sorry to sound like a sort of voice of moderation here, but is there something short of doing a written constitution on the lines that you talk about which might make the whole so kind of avoid a kind of Brexit Mark II situation. I mean, I'll look at address some of the sort of disasters that have befallen us. You know, the nature of a referenda, that the referendum with 50% plus one, Parliament not knowing what it's doing, you know, the potential to leave with no deal without us quite knowing whether the Prime Minister can or not. I mean, presumably no. I mean, presumably unless you have a written constitution, well, you can't stop any of that.
I mean, the advantage of having had a written constitution in this context is that there would be a process for amending it. You know,
right.
And you'd have text there that says we are part of the European Union.
You'd
think, well, we have to remove that text, right?
Right.
So now we have to use the formula for removing it. Someone would have thought, well, what's the role of Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland in this formula? You know, is it entrenched? Is it a supermajority? I tend to think that. To answer your question more directly, if you think, is there a halfway house between what I'm proposing and what we have now? Well, I was inclined to say a statute that would specify a constitutional amendment formula, at least a process for deciding these kinds of things. But unless you have a definitive list of what is constitutional, it's very hard to do that. You can't really do it.
And there is a sort of oddity here, which is that constitutional change has happened in the last 20 years. You've had devolution to Scotland and Wales.
Indeed. At breakneck pace.
European Convention of Human Rights incorporated into British law. The Fixed Term Parliament Act, which is a sort of bolted-on thing.
Exactly, yeah. So are you suggesting we could do more piecemeal change?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, it's slightly odd that we've got piecemeal change without anything for it to sort of latch onto.
I mean, I was just sitting here thinking that the fact that you as an MP are suggesting perhaps we could do it, you know, not the full thing, but just a little piecemeal way of doing it is a very classic, you know, UK way that we would resolve this. We'd say, well, that's too difficult, that full process. Is there just a little bit we could take, you know, deal with around the edge? And that's, I guess, your argument is that some people think that served us well, but actually, when you get into a situation like Brexit where so many things come into play, you know, something like the Fixed Term Parliaments Act was created in a very particular context to deal with a situation that the coalition government, it was essentially created to give the Liberal Democrats confidence that the Conservatives weren't going to pull the plug on the government, you know, partway through the Parliament. Nobody would have thought at the time about the situation we're currently in with a minority government supported by the DUP and, you know, what happens if a prime minister, you know, a party elects someone as prime minister who it turns out not to have the confidence of the House of Commons, and what does that do to elections and so on.
Right. Should we go to the audience?
Hi. If there was a written constitution, is there much appetite in this country for more of a judiciary supremacy, like the interpretation of the Constitution by the judiciary?
Really good question about the role of the judges, which is one of the potential objections.
Indeed.
So I guess I'm still not sold on the problem statement. It feels to me like where we do have written constitutions, that's often just a situation where the debate gets moved into a different realm, effectively. It's not like in America, as you kind of pointed out, that where they have a written constitution, that those issues don't still end up being very hotly debated or very complex to try and work their way through. If the politicians want to do something, they try to find their way. So I'm still not sure why we're saying that a written constitution is definitely better.
Let me ask you, can you just hold the microphone for a second? So I guess my...
This wasn't the deal. I thought I just said one thing.
I guess my thing would be they're definitely bad, problematic written constitutions, but what would you say to the argument that Brexit is the kind of guiding, is the problem sort of thing, that if a country can get into such a mess... So an American... actually, a guy called Joe Scarborough, who presents Good Morning Joe in America, said to me... he said, what kind of country has like one referendum on one day and then that's it for like the, you know, you suddenly your country takes like this kind of massive kind of sharp turn and there's no checks and balances? And I didn't know what the answer to that question was.
So I guess in my mind, that was, the referendum was foolishly worded. So
right.
We could have set it up in a way where it was better managed. It was clear that the question was you know, in or out. It didn't give any of the detail that we needed to be able to actually act on it.
Right.
So
it was a specific problem with the nature of the referendum.
Specific problem with the nature of the referendum, but also unclear to me why, if we'd had a constitution, that would have changed the result of the referendum. So not the result of the referendum, but the what's come after it and how we've had to interpret it and all those other issues that have fallen around the referendum.
Interesting.
Shall I start with judges? So I think if you look at polls which ask people who they have confidence in, judges come pretty high at the moment, certainly higher than members of parliament. But so, you know, you could say that there's appetite, therefore, for, you know, judges to have, a role in our system. But equally, when we had the Miller case with, the courts being brought in to decide whether Parliament had to pass a law in order for Article 50 to be triggered, when that, you know, judgment was handed down, then we had, you know, popular newspapers arguing that these were, I can't remember the phrase, but enemies of the people. And, you know, and that is, quite unusual in our system, that actually the rule of law would be, you know, decisions of the judiciary would have been questioned in that way. That's quite a new situation for us to be in. So I think, you know, it's not necessarily clear that people have massive appetite for judges to decide everything.
But do you think judges would be more engaged if we had a written constitution? Because the judges seem pretty engaged, have been pretty engaged throughout this process.
There's definitely an argument that if you're codifying, there's a strong possibility there's going to be more laws, and it's judges' role is to interpret and apply the law as passed by Parliament. But that's like that last bit I think is important. So it's if you had a situation where the Constituent Assembly was coming up with the Constitution, and then that had to go through Parliament, and then judges have to take into account what they think Parliament meant when a law was passed. So it's not just judges coming up off their own bat with what they think should happen. But there are worlds, I think, Jeff, and I can't remember, sorry, your proposal, whether the actual putting into law of the Constitution in your scenario would happen directly from the Assembly, or whether the Parliament would still have a role in that at the end.
Parliament's role would be consultative during the writing of the Constitution and nothing greater. And that's one of the reasons why the argument we don't have time for this doesn't apply here, because you constitute a separate assembly to do that, and then government gets on with its business managing the disaster. The question about is there an appetite to give judges a stronger role? I think the general answer is no, there isn't such an appetite. And there is also virulent opposition to doing exactly that. Why not? Well, someone who believes in bills of rights, and myself and many of my colleagues, we're not so keen to massively increase the role of judges, because we don't want the judiciary to become politicized. We don't want the appointments process to become a circus like it is in the United States. And because we think the balance that's shown of restraint but good faith interpretation of rights that exists presently is fairly good in interpreting things like the Human Rights Act. So there's no strong call for that. It's certainly not in my argument. But would having a written constitution, by the very nature of it being a written constitution, not increase the role played by judges? My view on that is that typically, historically, there are two sites in which judges get very involved. One is enforcing the Bill of Rights, and the other is in dealing with federal questions. You know, which is it, Scotland or is it Westminster that has these powers? We already have legal frameworks for both of these now, and contrary to what some say, the role of judges has not been that spectacular. There's been very, very little litigation about devolution, and the Human Rights Act cases that have led to legislative amendments have been very, very small in number, much smaller than what you get in Canada or Germany or even France.
What about the problem case? The problem is
let me
it's not solving a problem. The other ways to sort of solve the problem.
Exactly. So first of all, I just want to comment on that. I mean, if I'm saying that in a true democracy, people, representatives, should decide what the law is. I don't have to prove that it will also do all these good things like raise GDP and so on. That's the reason that I like this argument. But I think, let's pick Brexit as an example. So I don't take the, you have one thing you need to remember about referenda questions is that if they're too nuanced, people don't know what they're voting for. That's why we have an electoral commission to do this. It has to be a really straight shot. And that means sometimes oversimplifying. Now, what would us having had a written constitution have done? So I think it wouldn't have stopped Brexit for this reason. The decision to call the referendum would probably have been an act of parliament. Once the referendum decision, even by a slim majority, was yes, I think at least 2/3 of parliament of MPs would have supported carrying out Brexit. So let's say your amendment procedure requires 2/3. That's not what I advocate, but most countries have something like that. It still would have got through. So what's the difference then? Well, if we had a written constitution, the role for the European Union, the role of Scotland, the procedure would have been spelled out. We wouldn't have had to have the Supreme Court case because everybody would have known there's a specific way you amend the constitution and it's these following steps. We are going to need an act of parliament. I also think that if, as what I'm proposing, you need a referendum to ratify constitutional amendments, then in the current situation, we would have had a second referendum. Because the first referendum was about whether to leave. The second referendum is to decide whether the specific proposal for how to amend the constitution and what the relationship with the EU would be would itself have to go again to the people. Now, that's not my sort of remainer way of trying to read
jiggery pokery.
No,
is that a word that this, people use? Just
I'll use it from now on.
Yeah,
that's not something that I built into. I just realized it shortly before giving the lecture on which this article is based. That would follow from my proposal. And lastly, I don't think we'd have the situation with a royal assent and prorogation of parliament if we'd codified the constitution within the last 20 years.
Okay. Do we want to ask about the Jeffocracy?
Yes. Yes.
Just finally.
So I think I'd be amenable to a constitution in the Jeffocracy
With a G rather than a J.
Yeah. But this is a beautiful moment—a J Jeff and a G Jeff sharing a stage.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a lovely thing to witness. what would if I put you in charge of the constitution, the pair of you? First thing, day one. What do you do?
Well, I think although you're a benevolent dictator, we should probably curb your powers and go through all the podcasts and work out all the precedents and
we should definitely curb his powers. Let me tell you.
And then we should
you know this is your
audience.
One shot at being prime minister.
Yeah, thank you.
You know that.
I know, but look, there's sometimes too high a price to pay.
But yeah, I think we need the buy-in of the podcast audience to ratify that these are the powers that you should have, Jeff.
Yeah. Jeff?
Oh, gosh. Well, if I were put in power in a true Jeffocracy with a J, it would be I'd probably want to keep the first-past-the-post system and keep things as they are because I could have much more power. But if I was being true to my beliefs, I think what I would do is suggest that we would have this... I mean, look... There, I have my views about what I would like to see in a constitution. I think you might be getting at this. You know, I think we should put social rights into the constitution, for instance. This is what a lot of my work has been about. But my case...
So this is like rights to...
Healthcare, social security.
So that's another thing that a written constitution could do.
It could. We'd put that... I think that probably... they might be there, they might not. Probably not in the current climate. I would argue for including them, but my argument today, the Democratic case, it doesn't talk about content. It only talks about the process. And it also has something to say about how deeply entrenched the Constitution is. Because if your argument is democratic, the people should decide, well, then you can't adopt a Constitution that will stay in force for, you know, many generations. It should be something that, or it should be kept in force against what a majority of people presently want. So, to answer your question more directly, I would say that I would institute this constituent assembly, let them get on with their work, and I would suggest that to abide by the democratic argument, the Constitution should not be deeply entrenched, should be amendable by Act of Parliament and referendum, and that the whole package should come up about once in a generation for renewal. That is, that the Constitution would automatically retire.
Would there be elections in this situation? Because I think Jeff's not keen on elections with a G. Is that right, Jeff?
If it's everyone else has been elected, it's fine. I'd just like to retain my position.
I'm not sure that's the way it would be working.
You could be there ex officio, maybe.
Okay. Jeff King, Hannah White, thank you so much for joining us.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
And let's bring on Nish Kumar. Edward's just saying we've made a real mess of the stage.
What a couple of mucky pups. Good Lord.
Have a seat, Nish. Thank you for coming. You were here yesterday.
I was here yesterday.
Same
doing...
room. Andy Zaltzman was recording his podcast, The Bugle, which you were
yes,
on quite often.
Yeah.
I noticed from Twitter that your mum was keen to come yesterday,
yeah.
But you didn't ask... None of your family asked for tickets to come today.
So, yes, my mum and dad really love Andy Zaltzman. Because if you don't know Andy Zaltzman, he's a brilliant satirical comedian. And he's also a cricket writer who writes for an Indian cricket website. So Zaltzman has an inexplicably large Asian fan base. Two of whom are Mr. and Mrs. Kumar.
So they didn't want to come and see
this. No, they did. Basically... I forgot to tell them that I was doing this podcast,
okay.
And I'm going to get a very angry text message when this podcast
from me.
Gets released.
No.
Yeah, I know also that your in-laws are podcast, your girlfriend's mum and dad are podcast fans, because we saw them with you at Pod Save America.
Yeah.
They didn't want free tickets either.
I basically forgot to tell everyone that I was doing this, and so I'm going to get a string of angry text messages from my parents and my partner's parents.
And your partner is dealing with quite a big issue.
Listen, we got a fatberg. We got a fatberg in the house, and
No,
it's like in the drains outside our house. There's a big, like, and the thing is, I didn't really deal with it last week. I just kept saying, I'll sort it out. And then on Saturday morning, there was sort of a deluge of human feces in our back garden. And,
what is you're supposed to deal with it?
You're supposed to call someone who knows how to. I don't know, plumbing, Ed.
Oh, I see.
I'm part of the Metropolitan Liberal
right,
Elite.
Right.
I don't know how to do plumbing.
Right.
I can barely even pronounce the word without saying the B. So anyway, we've called a guy and he's sort of got a big. But anyway, yesterday, as I was sort of standing there in a mess entirely of my own making, I felt very close to Leave voters for the first time, just refusing to acknowledge there's a problem.
Were you being blamed in the office in the house for this?
No. I think what's happened is we sort of moved house very recently, and I think we've essentially inherited a fatberg. It's like when people move into a house in Scooby Doo and there's a ghost there, except instead of a ghost, it's a lump of human feces.
Now, I wanted to ask you: you did a big tour around the country recently, but you've also done some shows in the States.
Yeah, sure.
As you present our situation, as you see it to them, how insane do we look?
Well, it's difficult because I feel like all of the Americans that I met believe that they are in more trouble than us. And I think, I don't know whether you may be able to correct me on this, I feel that we are in more trouble than America because they have a constitutional... If he wins next year, they deserve everything. But... they still have a sort of constitutional mechanism to scrutinise the kind of catastrophic decisions they make. But
he will also be gone after 8 years. I mean, he'll definitely be gone after 8 years.
Again, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Like, we hope that he's got... I saw a really upsetting Time magazine kind of digital front cover last week where they just had billboards for Trump campaigning for the next election for the next 4 years onwards and onwards and onwards. And but in theory, he has to go, whereas we are trapped in a ceaseless Groundhog Day nightmare.
Yeah.
They're very downbeat about their prospects, and they're sort of more... I think they have a sort of faith in us that is completely unfounded.
Still.
Still, yeah. I still think they feel... Well, certainly the Americans that I performed to... When I say Americans, it was in New York. So I mean Americans in the loosest form of the term. But yeah, they were more upbeat about our prospects than we are about theirs. But they're very baffled by the whole thing, in my experience.
As are we.
As are we.
You brought along some ideas, Nish, which
yeah,
should
sure.
be potential reasons to be cheerful if we pass them
yeah,
in the
sure.
Jeffocracy. Do you want to give us your first one?
Yeah, my first one is anyone who refers to it as climate change from now on
is forced, should have to be strapped to the exhaust of a car for a full day and have the fumes pumped directly into their lungs. Like, I think at this point, you got to be using the phrase climate crisis or fucking nightmare. Like, those are the only two acceptable terms for climate change right now. Like, I think that phrase climate change is such a rhetorical problem for all of us because it just seems like, oh, it's climate change. Be fine. Global warming sounds good. Like, that sounds something that's positive. And we those sort of words that we use to describe it are, I think,
what should we be using then?
Hitler.
What should I be using? What should I be using?
Just something crisis. That...
Climate crisis.
Climate crisis.
You should speak in a panicky voice as you say it.
Yeah. I think that those kind of words and terms matter.
Well, you think it sounds too soothing?
I think it sounds fine. Yeah. Climate change, you're like, oh yeah, that means it'll probably rain later. Like, I think that's genuinely how people view it, rather than... You know, there's a meteor 5 minutes away from hitting us and we need to do something about it.
Do you think it's changed, though, with climate rebellion? The message has got through to a lot more people, even in the past year or so.
Yeah, I feel like that. But on the other hand, there seem to be a lot of people, based on the news this week, who are in favour of strangling the climate protesters by the neck. Like, the fallout of that, the way that that's been written about... I mean, I saw Julie Hartley Brewer, who's not a good bellwether for anything, except possibly the majority of the British electorate... say something like, well, in a few years we'll
she's
all
coming
feel
along
like...
later, by the way.
She said, well, in a few years we'll all feel like doing this. And, you know, she sort of said that on a radio program, and you're kind of like, why are you annoyed, without getting into any of the issues, that people shouldn't strangle other people, which I can't believe I'm having to say is a thing that's bad.
We've got to relearn that lesson.
Yeah. You can't strangle women.
We could put that in a constitution.
I think it's in there, in the law. but yeah, I think the way that the sort of fallout of that is, I think is very weird. I don't know what it is, but for some reason this week has really bummed me out. Like, I know that it's...
Not just the Fatberg.
If anything, the Fatberg has been the fun, like a bit of light relief.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, Western democracy is collapsing. But on the other hand, there's a big lump of poo blocking my drains. but I don't know, for some reason, this week has really bummed me out. Like, I feel like the way that the Boris Johnson story has been reported and everyone's been like, oh, I can't believe those bloody Remainers calling the police because a woman was screaming. Like, then the Mail this morning has done a, like, Sims House recreation of the flats. And you're like, it was someone's job to do that. What the fuck is wrong with you people? And then the fact that Donald Trump this week has had another serious allegation leveled at him and he's just sort of shrugged it off without any problem seems fundamentally depressing to me. And the fact that, you know, an MP sort of strangled a woman and lots of his colleagues have come out kind of being like, well, she could have had a gun. And you're like, he strangled her. Was the gun in her mouth? The hell is wrong with these people?
I suppose what is also disturbing about that is it's the first obvious time that Brexit, the sort of poison of Brexit has spread to a different issue because that wasn't about Brexit.
Yeah, completely.
I mean, you know, it was about...
But somehow it's all now kind of part of, like, there's a sort of culture war that you find yourself either side of, and somehow it's able to take in your position on Brexit, your position on women's rights, your position on gay rights, and for some reason also your position on whether or not humans should continue to live on this planet. Like, I would have thought that would be a pretty universally, like, we're all in favour of that. Can I sort of suggest
something, which is maybe it's only the people on Twitter who are in this war. Or at least it's a lot the people on Twitter in this war.
Yeah, but the problem is some of the people on Twitter are members of parliament. That's the issue, really, is that we can talk about the culture war as being something that sort of happens on social media. But Johnny Mercer is a member of parliament, and he was out defending Mark Field this week. And Johnny Mercer is going, you know, and he is going to have a say in the direction of the next government as we go into the crucial phase, or we're told the latest round of crucial phases.
I mean, I want to hold on to the idea that most people don't think, you know, what Mark Field did is acceptable.
Yeah, so do I.
The climate crisis is real. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I'm sort of struggling because it feels like culturally, and I think Brexit has done this, is it's created this kind of polarisation where it's not really just about where you stand on the European Union. It's actually emblematic of all of your values.
And do you find it with your audiences?
No, my audiences are, I mean...
Self-selecting.
We're living in the Milliverse, his audience.
Yeah, I think my audience may be living somewhere to the left of the Milliverse.
Right.
Like, my audience... I literally walked out in Birmingham, and there was a row of people wearing Pride T-shirts, and a man had bought an EU flag to wave, and you're like, this is not representative of the British public.
But yeah. That's great. You get to live in a parallel universe some of
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, I totally live in a completely different, like, adjusted reality where everyone is just very groovy. And, like, it's really just
a bit like this audience. Give yourself a cheer for being groovy.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I'm very aware that I've, like, I did... whatever it is, 60 tour dates over a period of about 6 months. And
did you meet a Leave voter?
Yes, yeah, sometimes. And they've the ones that... There's two types of Leave voter that come to see me. One of them is the people who are like, I still think you're funny. Like, it's like a sort of badge of honour that they're able to enjoy the comedy. And you're like, all right, fine. I don't know what you got out of it, but fair enough. And then there's sort of another Leave voter who gets angry and on two or three occasions heckled me. And I tried to sort of open up a meaningful line of dialogue with them. And on every occasions, they walked out. And I said to my tour manager, why is this happening? I'm trying to open a line of dialogue. And he's like, listen, they love to leave. If you...
He's funny, your tour manager.
He's very funny. It's like, if you're opening up...
You should be on the stage.
If you've defined yourself in opposition to a group of people who likes to leave things, there is a chance they're going to walk out.
But you see, I want to defend Leave voters. I think most... Well, I think many Leave voters would find you funny. And that you had a lot of values in common.
Yeah. But I think that those aren't the kind of Leave voters that are going to kick off. Like, they're not going to kick off if they come to the show.
Right.
So they're not the kind of Leave voters that you hear from, really. And that's sort of the problem, I think, with Brexit as a whole, is that at no point, from minute one, when she said Brexit means Brexit and no deal is better than a bad deal, she immediately deleted the existence of non-hard Brexit Leave voters.
Yeah.
I think it created a paradigm by which the only way to be in favour of Brexit was to be in favour of a kind of no-deal, hardest of hard, post-Viagra erection, hard Brexit.
Yeah.
Like, that was the only way that it could possibly exist. Yeah. And as soon as she did that, and I've sort of seen people, you know, there's sort of various discussions going on about that, and I've seen people say, well, it's kind of hard Remainers who drove things the other way. But I feel that by coming out and immediately saying no deal is better than a bad deal, she created the idea that the only version of Brexit is the hardest possible Brexit. And we're sort of living in the consequences of that decision. Because even when Boris Johnson was sort of criticising her, he would often refer to the Mansion House speech as being an example of when he was in favour of Theresa May's Brexit policy. So she sort of created a stick by which her opponents could beat her with.
Another idea, Nish.
Every decade you lose another form of social media. Like, every decade.
Ooh,
I think every decade you should have one social media taken off you. And I don't mean, like, randomly. I mean specifically. I think if you're 30 years old and you're still on Snapchat, you should be on a register. I think that is absolutely unacceptable. Snapchat is a place for teenagers, and you are there hanging around being like, hey guys, remember Blur v Oasis? Get out!
Let's have some honesty. Who here is over 30 and on Snapchat?
Straight off. On a register. Register. Pedo.
So when you turn 30, you lose
Snapchat's
Snapchat.
Gone.
You
right,
turn
40.
40, what happens?
You lose Instagram.
Okay.
People over 40 posing like this, fuck off. then at 50, you Twitter. You got to go. Twitter, you shouldn't be...
I've got 6 months left.
Make them count, Ed.
Yeah, make the most of them.
Make them all count. And
I'm not quite like enforced retirement from Twitter, actually.
Yeah, I think it might, you know, I think it might actually help everyone. And then at 60, Facebook, right? The thing, people over 60 having political arguments over Facebook, it is so... Like, I have a great uncle in India, and sort of in my family in this country, there is no real... Like, we all voted Remain. There's no real... We don't have that thing that... I have white friends of mine that, like, have to impose no politics conversations rules at family dinners and stuff to maintain kind of order and decorum. We don't really have that broadly in my family, but both sides of my family is from India, and the kind of great schism there is over whether you are pro-Modi or anti-Modi. And I see those kind of arguments play out on Facebook, and like my grandma's brother, it's like my great uncle, who's like in his 70s, it's like posting memes, like dank memes on Facebook. And you're like, you have grandchildren. Like, this is not okay. And
also, what is a dank meme? Is that the Fatberg? Is that anything to do with the Fatberg?
It's the intellectual equivalent of a Fatberg. I never thought I'd be in a situation where Ed Miliband was asking me what to explain the phrase dank meme. It's like trolling. It's shitposting, right.
He's doing that to whom? Your
the other half, the anti BJP section of my family.
And what are they doing back?
They're sort of like being like, you piece of shit, and you know, these are all people. It's so funny when they go, because you know, we in some ways we're a very non-traditional Indian family, but in other ways we're a very traditional Indian family. So like when you greet your elders, the idea is if you're a younger person, you literally bend over and touch their feet. Right. And so we are now in a situation where people are coming in, touching the elders' feet, and then standing up and being like, you've piece of shit. Like, it's such a weird... My mum won't let me join at her Indian family WhatsApp group because she says it is, and this is a direct quote, so filled with bile, I'm worried it will affect your mental health. Like, and I just think that if you're over 60 and you're absorbing, the number one source of your information is Facebook. I think, honestly...
Yeah, I think that is scary.
Yeah, it's scary.
Or even under 60, actually.
Because also, I think that you don't...
God, I was having an argument with someone on the train about Agenda 21. Has anyone ever heard of Agenda 21? It's some innocent UN document that's become a big right-wing conspiracy theory. And I was arguing with a woman who lives in Stoke-on-Trent that it wasn't... The world wasn't going to have some like massive...
This is why you shouldn't talk to people on public transport. I keep telling you.
In 2021, there wasn't going to be some kind of communist homosexual revolution, which is what Agenda 21 is all about. She said it was absolutely true. And then I said to her, you know, honestly, you shouldn't believe what you read on Facebook. You know, things like the BBC, they're more reliable. She said, the BBC, no way. Now, that did test Facebook is a disaster in that respect, isn't it?
But I do think that there's something about when you grow up with the internet, if you've grown up with the internet from an early age, and I mean, this is not entirely true, but people who are closer to being what's called digital natives, I think have...
Is that you?
No, I think I'm just...
On the cusp.
I'm just too old to be a digital native. I think basically everyone
borderline
that's
millennial.
Younger than me. Yeah, borderline millennial. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think that when you grow up with
He
the
is
internet,
borderline millennial.
Yeah, all right.
I think you guys...
I'm allowed to be on Twitter for another 4 years.
Yeah, okay, don't rub it in.
Well, your constituency is millennials, I think. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, ish. Yeah, yeah.
Not so much that guy, but...
Does that give us sort of vicarious...
Yeah, you have
sort of Twitter rights.
Honorary millennial status, but in four...
What'd you give up at 70?
Oh, by the... I don't think there's anything left. LinkedIn.
You're not allowed to...
get off LinkedIn at 70. If the career in recruitment hasn't happened by 70, it's not going to happen. Between 60 and 70, fire away on LinkedIn because there's a limited amount of damage you can do.
I mean, in all seriousness, isn't it better just to not look at these things?
Yeah,
I mean, Twitter is awful. I went through a period of 3 months where I was off it, I think in late 2018. And it was really, I really found it good being not on it.
But you got sucked back in again, why?
I did, I don't know. I just don't know.
Cheap thrills,
you know.
Well, also, we're all... I mean, you guys are, you know,
dank
podcasters.
Memes.
You guys are purveyors of dank memes.
Yeah.
Didn't it feel great when you changed your name on Twitter to Chaos with Ed Miliband and you got 17,000 retweets and 42,000 likes? Think of the dopamine.
Though. It's all sort of, you know, playing with your head, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, there's a certain level of professional obligation for some, like... You know, it's currently the most effective way to promote shows and promote tours and stuff like that.
I just find people kicking the shit out of each other on Twitter so awful. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I never thought I'd be in defense of Twitter, but the only thing I will say is that being on Twitter has definitely opened my mind to, because there is no editorial filter. On the one hand, you're seeing the worst of humanity. But on the other hand, I don't think... You know, like, I would have almost no awareness of trans issues without social media. I think that that's, like, a really positive thing. Reading trans writers on Twitter is a really positive thing. I think things like Black Lives Matter, that was facilitated, and even the Me Too movement, that was facilitated by hashtag-based participation. Yeah. And I don't think that those two movements could have grown so organically in an older media landscape. So I think that, you know, it's a double.
No, I've got
sword.
6 months left. And then I'm off.
Hey, enjoy LinkedIn.
Yeah, exactly. for another 20 years.
What's your last idea?
Politicians are not allowed legally to appear on comedy panel shows.
I've turned down every comedy
panel show.
I know.
That's why I knew I was safe saying it.
Yeah.
I respect the hell out of that.
Yeah.
I just think that it's not done us any good. You know, I don't think in 30 years' time, I mean, I don't think anyone looks at it now, but I don't think in 20 years' time anyone's going to be like, thank goodness Trump hosted SNL. That really was a satirical jab in the eye for his prospects. You know, it sort of created a bit of an... And listen, I am part of the same problem, because I also think this has to work the other way. If you can't have politicians on comedy panel shows, you can't have comedians on Question Time. And I'm happy to forego that day of stress.
And why do you think, what's been the lasting arm?
I think
Boris Johnson.
I think Boris Johnson is the straw that broke this Asian's back.
Have I Got News For You
a lot. He was on Have I Got News For You a lot. Nigel Farage has been on it. Jacob Rees-Mogg has been on it. And the thing is,
Nick Clegg was on it.
Nick Clegg, in many ways, the worst.
Yeah.
He's the worst. He's the facilitator of it. He's the Richard Hammond of this dynamic. For those of you who've seen that Stuart Lee routine about Top Gear, Clegg is the Richard Hammond of the destruction of British political discourse. Anyway, what was I saying? Nick Clegg's the worst. Anyway, I had to stop my father from yelling at him at a Guardian event once. My dad is so angry about Nick Clegg because my dad feels that he sort of betrayed... Anyway, all of that stuff.
So what, he was going to yell...
I think it wouldn't have been particularly coherent. It might have been something like, fuck you, Clegg.
Imagine being mistaken for Nick Clegg, which happens to me.
Why
do
you
amount.
Get mistaken?
I know.
I mean, I get mistaken for Ramesh. So I'm like, in many ways, we've all got problems.
I know. White guy in a suit, I guess. I mean,
I just think that it's generally part of... I don't think that the line between politicians and entertainers should be as blurred as it is right now. People say to me, are you going to run for office? And I go, are you fucking high? Like, what? I am not qualified. And the very fact that people are even having entertaining conversation about it.
Why do you say yes to Question Time then?
Because I also have this... I got really drunk... And Question Time was on, and it was a bunch of people that I disagreed with. And they had been asking me, and I had said no, because
don't
I had
watch
this kind
it,
of principle.
Honestly, Nish.
I know, but I was
really shit-faced. Don't watch it.
And but if you're a comedy fan, especially don't watch it, because you might risk seeing that thing that comes on after Question Time.
It's gone.
Oh, yeah.
Like the first two
it's
minutes
gone,
of that
gone.
Program.
It's gone. It's gone. Yeah. And anyway, I will not say anything about Andrew Neil, because he does not like me, and he has made those views very clear, and I do not wish to stoke the beef any further.
Should we stoke the gammon?
That's your phrase. Your phrase, Jim.
I am disassociating myself from that remark.
I think Andrew Neil is a very respectable broadcaster, and his hair is definitely real. I think all of those things. I think all of those things. He is one of our nation's leading lights. And it's not a wig.
You agreed to go on, basically, in a drunken moment.
I've been on a few times because I also have this weird deluded... When you're brown, I don't know why I said it like that, sometimes you feel an obligation, which may be a completely deluded sense of, you know, self-importance or whatever. You have a sense that you have to say yes to these things because you are somehow representing your community and you are representing the views of... people of colour, and because there's so few of us that achieve prominence in the kind of media landscape, when you get asked, you sort of have a responsibility.
And how was it?
Yes. You know, it
how
was
the experience for you? Well, I'm sure you did well. But...
I did three, and the experience was sort of like it was the first time I did it, I was physically sick all day, like literally unwell, like no fatberg, let's put it that way. Like it was very thin. But it was fine because I was on with Piers Morgan, which actually made me feel legitimized, because you're like, if he's on it, I can definitely be on it. Like, I'm an idiot, but he's it's much stupider than me, right? Like, And
oh
so
my
it,
God,
the first,
that
the,
is
yeah, the first
I mean,
two times
like
was
a,
fine. The third
like
time was the only time that it was properly. It was a bad atmosphere because I had an argument with Melanie Phillips, and I slightly lost my composure in that moment, which I sort of regret because you shouldn't. I don't think you should give these people the satisfaction of knowing that they got to you, but she did really get to me.
Nish, anything that you need to get people to buy tickets to?
Edinburgh. I'm doing Edinburgh the last 6 days of the...
What's it called?
It's In Your Nature to Destroy Yourselves. It's both a description of our current political climate and a quote from Terminator 2.
It sounds like a reason to be cheerful.
Is that a reason to be cheerful?
I think so.
You've seen the show,
laughs.
Jeff.
There'll be laughs.
People feel optimistic at the end?
Yes, there is some really contrived optimism at the end that is in no way genuine, but is just designed to end the show with a sort of semi-satisfying atmosphere.
Do you think the Fatberg will be defeated by then?
I think, hopefully, I'm hoping once I take my phone off airplane mode, the Fatberg will be dead.
Do it now.
Imagine if I get a text message saying the house has been consumed by the Fatberg.
I mean, this is the first time I can honestly say that I have done a live commentary on whether a Fatberg has been
dissipated.
Eliminated or not. this is worth losing the general election for, honestly.
It's dead. The Fatberg is dead. Fatberg is dead.
Kumar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff King and Hannah White. Thank you to you. You've been a brilliant audience. Give yourself a big round of applause.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Thank you.